doesn't know what to do, but it's also very difficult to reform because it's so corrupt and the whole sort of system of government is based on corruption.
And protests are also in Lebanon as well, is that right? I spoke to the Iraqi president, Barham Saleh, at the United Nations, and asked him about the pressure on his thoughts about the U.S. putting so much pressure on Iran. In the last 10 seconds we have, Trump ramping up that pressure on Iran, how does that affect Iraq?
It raises the political temperature. It means that all this is taking place, this sort of crisis which revolves around economic disaster.
Patrick Coburn, we're going to have to leave it there. I thank you so much, Middle East correspondent for The Independent.
Hello out there. This is Jello Biafra. If you're tired of the OCA, Walt Disney, Westinghouse, General Electric, and police departments telling you what you should listen to, stay tuned in to KBOO Portland, listener-sponsored non-commercial community radio, 90.7 on your FM dial unless your FM was made in America.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Sweet Creek Foods, family-owned and operated in Elmira, Oregon, sourcing local organic ingredients and supporting Pacific Northwest farmers and fishermen, offering organic products including salsas, pickles, jams, tomato and enchilada sauces, and Oregon albacore tuna, all packaged in sustainable glass. More information, including product locator map, at sweetcreekfoods.com. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Grundle's Coffee House, located at East Burnside Street and 8th Avenue in Portland, offering organic coffee, soup, sandwiches, and more for breakfast and lunch. Grundle's Coffee House is open daily until 5 p.m. More information on the Grundle's Facebook page and by phone at 503-595-9550.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
KBOO Evening News tonight, we have right-wing member Tusitala Tainitosi arraigned today on an assault indictment.
A car crashed through a southeast Portland kombucha tap room.
And in international news, drinking and driving has serious consequences, even for October enthusiasts driving electric scooters in Germany.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News from Monday, October 7th, 2019. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Michelle Coppola. For former Portland Police Sergeant Greg Lewis, it's possible that locker room talk on the job will have serious consequences. Co-workers reported that Lewis made inappropriate racial remarks during roll call in a locker room recently. The incident began on a Sunday afternoon when conversation turned to media coverage of police shootings in Portland. There were news article comments that officers, quote, shoot to wound white people, but shoot to kill African-American people. In his explanation of what happened next, Lewis told the committee deciding his fate in the police department, quote, I was just merely saying, you know, well, you just need to be smart on how you detox people, unless, of course, it's a black guy and we just shoot them. Lewis apologized for the comments and acknowledged they were wrong, adding, it was very flip, it was off the cuff, and it was inappropriate. I have accepted that as a supervisor. I should have known better. It just rolled off and my mouth got ahead of my brain. Further recommendations will be made by the State Board of Public Safety and Standards Training on October 24th.
Thousands of runners participated in Portland's annual marathon early Sunday morning along a newly revised route. The revamped course directed runners through some of Portland's most iconic and scenic neighborhoods. The new route largely garnered praise from runners despite major road reroutes and bridge delays for commuters. Organizers for the race said they had runners from all 50 states and 18 countries for 2019. Just over 6,000 competed this year, with estimates of 10,000 predicted for 2020. Prior routes for the marathon included stretches of industrial landscape along Highway 30. The new course took runners across the Selwood Bridge into surrounding neighborhoods of Selwood, West, and East Moreland. In January, the city of Portland picked Utah-based race producer Brooksy to be the new organizer after complications and legal turmoil with the previous marathon's organizers. 22-year-old Colin Kahn took the victory on Sunday. The Chicago native transplanted to Portland 2 years ago and won the marathon with an impressive time of under 2 hours and 26 minutes.
Southeast Portland's Soma Kombucha taproom received an unexpected visitor last Friday afternoon when a car crashed through its glass garage door storefront. Surveillance video of the event showed an empty taproom with one woman sitting at a table near a window. After loud screeching sounds, the woman leapt from her seat, narrowly avoiding a careening auto smashing through the nearby glass door entrance. Portland police told Oregon Live that no crime was committed and that the crash was due to a traffic collision. No citations were issued. The woman was an employee of the taproom and was unharmed. Jean-Pierre Parent, the owner of Soma Kombucha Taproom, said the damage could have been worse. The car damaged a kegerator besides shattering the glass garage door, and that upholstery embedded with shards of glass will need to be replaced.
The U.S. Supreme Court began hearing arguments in a case today that could have major impact on Oregon's legal system. Ramos versus Louisiana deals with split jury convictions, and Oregon is the last state in the union to allow split jury convictions at the state level. At the federal level, the Sixth Amendment guarantees the right to a unanimous verdict, and it's possible that the court could extend this protection to the states using what is known as 14th Amendment incorporation doctrine. Oregon's split jury rules have roots in racism and xenophobia, dating back to anti-immigrant sentiment in the 1930s. Oregon Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum has supported an Oregon measure to overturn split juries going forward, but also submitted a brief to the Supreme Court in defense of it in this case, fearing that a decision to outlaw the practice could produce too many cases to be relitigated under new standards. Eliza Kaplan, a law professor at Lewis and Clark College and co-founder of the Oregon Innocence Project, told the Portland Mercury that even the potential for overwhelming the courts isn't a good reason to oppose the law change. Kaplan said the Constitution should always trump any administrative inconvenience or burden. This is about preserving individual rights and liberties. Too much justice is not really a problem. The Supreme Court will return a verdict on Ramos versus Louisiana by June 2020.
The Build Small, Live Large 2019 Summit comes to Portland in November, and they'll be considering the role that tiny homes and smaller dwellings can have in tackling the housing affordability crisis. KBOO's Kevin Dugan has more.
A conference next month will explore how tiny homes can be a big part of life in Oregon. The Build Small, Live Large 2019 Summit is a biennial event looking this year at housing affordability. It comes on the heels of a bill passed in the Oregon legislature earlier this year that says cities must allow a mix of housing types, referred to as inclusive zoning, rather than the traditional single-family zoning. Eli Spevak is the founder of Orange Splot, a contracting company that builds clusters of tiny homes and affordable housing units. He's speaking on several panels about the new landscape for smaller housing.
A lot of times single-family zoning encourages new homes to be all 2,600 square foot. That's about the average size in Portland. And we know that the demographic changes and increasing cost of housing, it's important to have smaller, less expensive housing options that the market can provide if the zoning code allows for it.
The summit includes 2 days of sessions starting November 7th at Portland State University. Reduced price tickets are available through October 18th. Carmel Perez-Snyder from AARP Oregon is on a panel delving into the accessibility issue for tiny homes. She says tiny homes often are associated with young people and include designs such as a loft you have to climb into, not taking into account people with mobility issues. But she notes that as the country ages, it's important to think about incorporating universal designs into these smaller homes.
Because a lot of older adults are finding that they want to literally downsize to something smaller. It works better for them. It's more affordable. Or they just want to have a smaller carbon footprint.
The first Build Small, Live Large summit was held in 2012, and Spevak notes the driving force behind it was how people could cut down their carbon footprint. He says a greater mix of smaller housing types in residential areas would help the climate.
It turns out that almost 80% of the climate impact of a house over its lifespan has to do with conditioning the space and heating the water, which scale with how big the house is.
For KBOO Evening News and the Oregon News Service, I'm Kevin Dugan.
Is that the smell of pancakes and adventure in your future? Well, yes, it is. On Sunday, October 27th, the grand opening of Portland's new Wildwood Trail pedestrian bridge will commence with a side of free, fluffy pancakes. However, the nonprofit organization behind this project, Portland Parks Foundation, asks for those who can to donate. The new bridge will connect hikers and pedestrians over the Burnside Bridge to safely travel and explore Portland's great outdoor adventures from Forest Park to the Hoyt Arboretum. It's expected the bridge will carry at least 80,000 outdoor enthusiasts every year, such as hikers and runners. Making this bridge a reality was a large undertaking. The Portland Foundation was able to raise $2.2 million in addition to garnering financial support from the City of Portland and Metro. And in honor of a Parks and Open Spaces leader who passed away, the bridge has been named the Barbara Walker Crossing. The executive director of the Portland Parks Foundation, Randy Cragg, said the bridge simply would not have happened without the community's commitment and generosity. To find out more about this event, you can visit barbarawalkercrossing.org.
A Lincoln County judge has overturned an ordinance banning the use of aerial pesticides. Judge Cheryl Bahart on September 30th ruled that state law preempts local governance efforts to regulate pesticides, noting Statute Chapter 634057. The Freedom from Aerial Sprayed Pesticides Ordinance was enacted in 2017 and was considered a major victory for both community self-governing and environmental welfare. The law was narrowly passed and quickly appealed by local timber industries and commercial fishermen. Judge Bahart's ruling has been viewed by many as a disappointing decision, siding with corporate industry over community well-being. The law was spurred on by local residents, chiefly by the Lincoln County Community Rights Organization. Rio Davidson, a member of LCCR, called the judge's ruling heartbreaking. Supporters of the ban's overturn maintain that pesticide use within the timber, farming, and fishermen communities is already carefully regulated by the Oregon Department of Agriculture and supporting agencies. Appeals will be filed by LCCR and the Siletz River Watershed. Currently, it's unclear if Lincoln County will also appeal that decision.
Tusitala Tiny Tosi appeared in a Portland courtroom this morning on assault charges following his arrest last Friday night. U.S. Marshals picked up Tosi on an outstanding warrant for assaulting a man in Northeast Portland in June 2018. Tosi's a member of the far-right group Patriot Prayer and the Proud Boys. A resident of Vancouver, he was known for coming to Portland with the group and assaulting anti-fascist activists. After he appeared in court this morning, Tosi said he felt good about the case and, quote, "I'm a proud Western chauvinist, and I refuse to apologize for creating a modern world." The phrase is a central tenet of the Proud Boys. They're classified as a general hate group by the Southern Poverty Law Center. Though the assault took place in June 2018, Tosi was not charged until February 2019, when Willamette Week reported on text messages between the Portland police and Patriot Prayer leader Joey Gibson. Prosecutors said the police had not released enough evidence for them to bring charges despite knowing of the assault. The text messages suggested that police were favoring the right-wing groups. Currently, Tosi's out on bail. He's been ordered not to contact his victims and to reside in Clark County, Washington during the case.
And the anti-hate organization Western State Center says the arrest of Tosi is an encouraging step forward. KBOO's Claire Risciotto has more on that story.
I spoke with Amy Hersfeld-Koppel, the deputy director of Western State Center, a progressive organization based here in Portland, Oregon, about today's arraignment of Tusitala Tosi, a.k.a. Tiny, a member of the Proud Boys and Patriot Prayer. Amy, can you introduce yourself and tell us more about your organization?
Sure. I'm in the deputy director of programs and strategic initiatives role at Western State Center. Western State Center is a more than 30-year-old civil rights organization that works in the Pacific Northwest and Mountain West states to build inclusive democracy.
Okay, great. Thanks for telling us more about what the Western State Center is. Can you talk a little bit about what the mission is, something that folks would most likely obviously see on your website?
Sure. So certainly folks will see on our website that we're an organization based in Portland supporting grassroots social justice leaders and organizations in the Mountain West and Pacific Northwest states to achieve racial and gender justice and help to build an inclusive democracy.
great. And as you know today, Tusitala Toes, also known as Tiny Toes, a member of the Proud Boys and Patriot Prayer, was arrested last Friday at the Portland airport and arraigned today on an assault indictment for an incident dating back to June of 2018. Eric Ward, the executive director of Western State Center, called the arrest an encouraging sign. Do you agree with that assertion?
Yeah, absolutely. So at Western State Center, you know, we are heartened that local law enforcement is taking Proud Boy violence seriously. We certainly feel like Tusitala should be held responsible for sowing chaos and violence in our community. And, you know, we look to local authorities to take further steps to prevent violence and intimidation and harassment like this by racist and sexist organizations active in our region.
Right. And can you tell listeners, why is this arrest so important?
So this arrest is important for a couple reasons. You know, first, this is an individual who's engaged in terrorizing and harassing our community, and particularly targeting marginalized communities. He's also part of a group that's relied on misogyny and homophobia and transphobia, among other bigoted ideologies, to recruit members. So, you know, certainly not safe for the community of Portland, but particularly folks who are targeted by bigoted ideologies, to have someone like Tusitala feeling free to target folks and not being held accountable by law enforcement. It also, I think, sends a clear message to racist and sexist organizations that are active in our region that law enforcement is prepared to prosecute, you know, criminal violence.
Speaking of law enforcement, specifically the City of Portland Police, what would you like to see the City of Portland Police do in regards to cases similar to Tusitala's case?
Sure. I mean, we just want a community where folks can live free from bigotry and violence and fear, right?
Mm-hmm.
Feel free to be themselves and not fear being targeted by you know, political violence or violent actors. So prosecuting criminal behavior and holding folks accountable who seek to sow that kind of chaos and undermine democratic institutions is an important line for law enforcement to hold.
For KBOO Evening News, I'm Claire Rosciato.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with the organizers of the 10th annual Portland Fermentation Festival, which takes place this Thursday. At 6, we'll hear Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio News and Views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather's cloudy with a high of 75, a low of 51. Tomorrow's weather will have a mixture of rain, and it will be cloudy with a high of 57 and a low of 38. Today in history, the author of The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness, Michelle Alexander, was born. Alexander has been a pivotal writer and author, raising awareness about institutional racial oppression in the U.S. The quote of the day is from Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow. Like Jim Crow and slavery, mass incarceration operates as a tightly networked system of laws, policies, customs, and institutions that operate collectively to ensure the subordinate status of a group defined largely by race.
And the KBOO Evening News continues. President Trump's decision to withdraw U.S. troops from northern Syria paves the way for a Turkish military offensive there, and it's drawn criticism from both Democrats and Republicans today. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell urged Trump to rescind his decision. McConnell said that, quote, a precipitous withdrawal of U.S. forces from Syria would only benefit Russia, Iran, and the Assad regime. McConnell was joined by other figures who usually support Trump, including Senator Lindsey Graham and the number three ranking House Republican, Liz Cheney. According to Cheney, pulling out of northern Syria represents an abandonment of our Kurdish allies, despite their vital contributions to the fight against ISIS. It emboldens Iran and serves as an undeserved gift to the Erdogan regime, which has only continued its steady march towards Moscow. Graham called the decision short-sighted and irresponsible and a stain on America's honor. Trump's move, announced Sunday night, is a critical reversal of U.S. foreign policy on Syria, which focused on protecting our Kurdish allies in the country. The decision to withdraw U.S. troops effectively enables Turkey to attack the Kurds. Turkish President Erdogan considers the Kurdish forces in Syria to be terrorists, allied with Kurdish insurgents within his own country. He has long threatened a military incursion into that area.
General Electric announced Monday it will be freezing the pensions of 20,000 U.S. salaried workers in an attempt to reduce its pension deficit and to trim debt. GE also said it will be offering lump sum pension buyouts to roughly 100,000 former U.S. employees who have not yet begun receiving their pensions. The industrial conglomerate will also freeze supplemental pension benefits for 700 executive-level employees. These moves indicate that corporate America pension plans are on the decline. GE hopes these decisions will reduce the company's pension liability by up to $8 billion. Effective January 1, 2021, these changes will not affect GE retirees already collecting pension benefits or employees with production benefits. The company's pension plan has been closed to new entrants since 2012.
Over 130,000 adults in Washington state were evicted from rental properties between 2013 and 2017. A new study shows that eviction is more likely when tenants lack legal representation. Eric Tegetthoff has the story.
Most renters facing eviction lack access to legal counsel, and because of that are set up to fail, says a new analysis. The Center for American Progress brief found nationwide about 90% of landlords have legal representation in eviction cases, while only 10% of tenants do. According to University of Washington research, more than 130,000 adults in the state were evicted between 2013 and 2017. Seattle attorney Andrew Ackley says even with favorable state laws on their side, renters still struggle to afford representation in Washington.
Facing the prospect of not just having to get caught up on rent, but also legal fees, people are pinched almost from the start to the point that some of them don't even bother. And they take a weaker position, settle for really less than they're entitled to, and essentially are at the whim of landlords.
The University of Washington research notes evictions, along with the housing affordability crisis, are contributing to the state's rising homelessness rate, now at its highest level since the Great Recession. Evictions also disproportionately affect people of color. Heidi Schulteis, co-author of the Center for American Progress brief, says an attorney can help a renter in a number of ways, such as negotiating additional time for them to move. Critically, she notes evictions stay on a person's credit report for 7 years, and legal counsel can ensure a filing doesn't go on to their records.
Landlords can and do discriminate against tenants with eviction filings on their records, even when the filing didn't actually result in an eviction. Even if the tenant goes on to win their case, that filing will go on your credit report.
Unlike criminal matters, defendants in civil cases aren't constitutionally guaranteed legal representation. But some cities have passed rights to counsel for evictions, and Schulteis says these cities are saving money. In New York City, renters with incomes at or below 200% of the poverty line are insured legal representation. She says the city did a cost-benefit analysis of this policy.
Based almost entirely on the savings that would accrue to the homeless services system, after the cost of providing legal counsel for tenants in eviction cases, the city would save $320 million every year.
For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegetthoff.
Over the weekend, 16-year-old climate activist Greta Thunberg met with Dakota Access Pipeline youth activist Dakota Iron Eyes on the Pine Ridge Reservation to discuss their shared purpose. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. 16-year-old climate activist Greta Thunberg traveled to the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota over the weekend. She joined a young Native activist who was involved in the 2016 opposition of the Dakota Access Pipeline. China Lockett has more.
Nearly 200 people crowded on the plastic bleachers of the high school gymnasium. Thunberg sits center stage on top of an aqua star quilt. Preventing climate change has been her focus since she learned about its effects. She drew international attention when she scolded world leaders at the United Nations. She says it's important for individuals to change their mindsets.
We should not see each other as groups of us and them, but as a whole us, because we are depending on each other in so many different ways.
Thunberg reminds the crowd that her home country, Sweden, and the United States are democracies. She says that means people can make the decisions and create change.
We need to show them what really matters to us and that this it is a matter of life and death for many people.
Thunberg encourages the crowd to mobilize and organize to push things in the right direction. 16-year-old Dakota Iron Eyes started her activism during the Standing Rock protest against the now-completed Dakota Access Pipeline. She says she wanted to ensure people have clean drinking water.
We know what we need as individuals, and we know what makes us happy, what makes us healthy. And the fact that we can recognize that and deny that to the people around us by being complacent is really a strange phenomenon.
Now, Iron Eyes focused on drawing attention to the Keystone XL pipeline. It would carry oil through parts of South Dakota. The state legislature is taking steps to criminalize protests.
We are at the edge of the cliff in regards to our timeline to save this planet. And the indigenous peoples will be the ones to lead the movement off of the edge.
For National Native News, I'm China Lockett in Pine Ridge.
The Canadian government is appealing a human rights tribunal order for compensation for First Nations children who were denied welfare. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, at stake is a compensation bill that could top $2 billion.
The Canadian Human Rights Tribunal order was for compensation for First Nations children who had been discriminated against by the government's child welfare system. The compensation was for $40,000 per child. Some 54,000 children taken by the welfare system are likely to qualify for the compensation, and that means Ottawa would be on the hook for about $2.1 billion. But the government of Prime Minister Justin Trudeau wants a judicial review, the tribunal decision set aside, and the claim for monetary compensation dismissed. Indigenous Service Minister Seamus O'Regan says the government needs more time.
And there's some big issues here, too, about how and who we recognize for compensation, mm-hmm. and issues about the scope of the tribunal as well. But just to speak to those survivors, there are issues about what years are relevant here. There are issues about how we go about identifying those survivors and avoiding, frankly, re-victimization. So there are some big issues here at play. We just need time.
Indigenous groups say they're outraged by the government's response. The Assembly of First Nations calls it beyond unacceptable, and Cindy Blackstock of the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society says it's beyond disappointing.
Instead of moving heaven and earth to stop that discrimination to children and to try and give some measure of justice to those who are harmed from it, they are trying to protect their own interests.
Prime Minister Justin Trudeau says he accepts the need for compensation, but there has to be talks with partners, communities, and Native leaders to get it right. The government had until October 7th to file an appeal. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
New Mexico's Trinity atomic bomb test site on the White Sands Missile Range is the subject of a new hearing concerning residents who are downwind of the test site. Roz Brown has that story.
Victim compensation from the nation's first atomic bomb test conducted in New Mexico nearly 75 years ago will be the subject of a field oversight hearing in Albuquerque today. In 1990, Congress passed the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act to provide money and health benefits for uranium miners and people living downwind from nuclear weapons tests who later developed serious illnesses. But Tina Cordova, who will testify today for the Tularosa Basin Downwinders Consortium, says those downwind from New Mexico's Trinity site were excluded from the legislation.
It has afforded compensation and health care coverage to other downwinders and some uranium miners. And the people of New Mexico, the downwinders of New Mexico, deserve not one dime more, not one dime less.
The government has paid out more than $2 billion in claims since 1990. New Mexico senators and House representative have introduced legislation in Congress to amend the legislation to include downwinders of the Trinity site. Today's hearing at the Southwestern Indian Polytechnic Institute is open to the public. From 1945 to 1962, the federal government conducted nearly 200 atomic bomb development tests. The current legislation compensates residents of Colorado, Idaho, Nevada, and Utah who were exposed to radiation from the Nevada nuclear test site. If the Compensation Act is amended, Cordova says many victims in New Mexico and the state's Indian country, including uranium workers who are living with lung and respiratory diseases, would be included.
Why are we treated differently? Why are we completely not included? It's a very well-kept secret that people were harmed and that people have been dying for 74 years now as a result of this.
In addition to Cordova, Jonathan Nez, president of the Navajo Nation, also will testify at the hearing. The current legislation is slated to end on July 9, 2022, while the proposed amendment would extend the compensation fund until 2045. For Public News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
Three scientists were jointly awarded a Nobel Prize in Medicine today based on the research on how cells adapt to oxygen availability. The Nobel Assembly announced the prize Monday at the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm, naming William Kalin, Peter Radcliffe, and Greg Semenza as the recipients. The scientists' work establishes genetic mechanisms that allow cells to adapt to fluctuations in oxygen levels. This research will have a direct effect on how we treat a variety of diseases, including cancer, anemia, heart attacks, and strokes. Randall Johnson, a member of the Nobel Assembly, told the New York Times, "This is a basic aspect of how a cell works, and on that standpoint alone, it's a very exciting thing." The Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine, administered by the Nobel Foundation, is awarded yearly for outstanding discoveries in the fields of life sciences and medicine. It's one of the five Nobel Prizes established in 1895 by Swedish chemist Alfred Nobel, the inventor of dynamite.
There are so many ways climate change is impacting our lives, even when it comes to our toilets. 60 million people in the U.S. use septic systems, and they can end up having useless systems in cases of droughts or flooding. For more on this and other stories, it's Week in Water.
Toilets could be impacted by climate change? That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
Three environmental groups are asking a federal court to order the government to consider tearing down the Glen Canyon Dam on the Colorado River in Arizona.
The new lawsuit follows the release of a 20-year operating plan by the Bureau of Reclamation, which the groups say does not take climate change into consideration. They say removing the dam, which creates Lake Powell, should have been an option.
Shrinking flows on the river and less snowpack due to climate change were not considered by the Bureau, according to Dan Beard, who spoke to the Salt Lake City Tribune.
Beard is a former commissioner of the Bureau of Reclamation and now serves on the board of one of the plaintiffs, Save the Colorado. He said that Glen Canyon Dam should be torn down.
However, Bureau officials have said in past interviews with the Tribune that Lake Powell plays a vital role in storing water from the Colorado River.
Gary Wachner, who heads Save the Colorado, said in a statement that the Bureau ignored the best available climate science that indicates there will likely not be sufficient flows in the Colorado River to keep Glen Canyon Dam functioning.
No response to the lawsuit has yet been filed by the government.
60 million people in the U.S., about one in five households, rely on septic systems, and many of them could be affected by climate change.
Septic systems can be rendered useless by flooding or drought, and in some areas, even a decline in snow, which insulates the ground from cold, can cause systems to freeze up and stop working.
A certain level of unsaturated dirt is needed to filter out contaminants, after which the waste fills a tank where bacteria break it down.
Higher water levels infiltrate that soil, leaving no filter. And in places like Florida, it's disappearing as sea levels rise.
The Weather Channel explains that failing septic systems allow contaminants to seep into groundwater supplies or wash into bays and rivers.
A developer in Miami told CNN that when his neighborhood floods, which can happen even when it's sunny due to high tides, they walk around in sewage, which is infested with bacteria.
While more rain and sea level rise will be a problem for those systems, more droughts caused by climate change will make it difficult to get the volume of water needed to keep septic tanks functioning in other areas.
A new gel-like fluid has been developed that may help prevent wildfires before they occur.
Researchers at Stanford say the gel, which contains non-toxic materials widely used in food, drugs, and cosmetics, could be sprayed in high-risk areas, protecting them against fire for months.
Currently, wildfire managers spray suppressants and retardants on buildings in the path of a fire, but they lose their effectiveness when they evaporate, often in less than an hour. The new product stays on targets even through exposure to wind and other factors.
The researchers, working with the state of California, found that treating areas prophylactically provides complete fire protection even after half an inch of rain. Traditional retardants would provide no protection in similar conditions.
According to a release from Stanford, many wildfires originate in the same hotspots, such as roadsides, campgrounds, and along remote electrical lines. Treating those areas could provide a highly targeted approach to wildfire prevention.
There's an increased awareness about the environmental impacts of textile production, and one area of concern is waterproof clothes that are made with toxic chemicals.
But making clothes with safer chemicals that also allows them to breathe has been a challenge.
Now, scientists have developed an ecological and water-repellent coating, which also retains breathability and the natural feel of clothing.
Researchers at Aalto University in Finland developed the coating from carnauba wax, which is used in medicines, food, and even car polish.
The wax comes from Brazilian palm trees, which protects its fronds from moisture loss by secreting a substance on leaf surfaces.
In a release from the university, the researchers explained that after processing, the new coating can be applied by dipping, spraying, or brushing on clothing surfaces.
However, because it's not resistant to detergents, it's best suited for less frequently washed outer garments like jackets.
While more research is still required, consumers may be able one day to apply the coating themselves to the textile after each wash.
And finally this week, if you find yourself along the East River in Upper Manhattan, look for colorful lights in the shape of a giant plus sign bobbing in the water.
A new floating sculpture there, called Plus Pool Light, is part science and part art. Lights change colors based on water conditions. If it glows blue, it's safe to swim. While if it's pink, that means bacteria levels exceed safety standards.
The sculpture, created by Playlab Inc. and Family New York, also changes direction based on water currents, turning clockwise when they're flowing north and counterclockwise when they flow south.
The brightness, frequency, and sharpness of the lights reflect the measurements of oxygen, turbidity, and pH, respectively.
The 50-by-50-foot lights are arranged into a plus sign to signify the positive steps New York City has taken since the passage of the Clean Water Act in 1972.
Shawnee Traylor, a science advisor for the project, told The Gothamist she thinks there are other possibilities of using data visualization. The Empire State Building could display air quality, or Central Park could show how much carbon it's sequestering.
Even if you're not in New York, you can see current water quality in the East River at an online dashboard where, at the time of this newscast, the water was low in pathogens but high in oxygen.
The installation is temporary and ends January 3rd.
This Week in Water is supported by the American Water Works Association, whose North American Water Loss Conference will showcase innovative solutions December 3rd through 5th in Nashville. Get the details at awwa.org/waterloss.
Zombie deer may sound like B-movie fodder, but wildlife officials maintain they're real and want them out of Nevada. The term zombie deer describes animals that have contracted chronic wasting disorder. The neurodegenerative disorder is highly contagious and terminal, affecting the brain and spinal cord of deer, elk, and moose. Infected animals roam 24 states in the U.S. The Nevada Department of Wildlife is urging hunters to check their carcasses at provided mobile testing stations placed near state lines. The testing is quick and does not affect the deer's meat or antlers. Symptoms of infected animals include emaciated appearance, drooling, and an aggressive, although dazed, manner. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, chronic wasting disease is spread by contact with bodily fluids or by drinking contaminated water. As of August, the CDC reported affected animals in 227 countries, with heavy concentrations in the states of Wyoming, Colorado, and Kansas. The risk of human contamination is low, but the CDC warns that the species barrier may not protect hunters, hikers, or campers from contracting the disease.
So what happens when a Texas man from an oil industry family takes a job in renewable energy? For more on that story, it's Anthony Leisowitz with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. During his 5 years in the Marines, Jake Thompson served in Iraq and Afghanistan. Afterward, he expected to return to Texas and work in the oil fields like his dad. But his father suggested a different path.
He really thought I should look into the wind industry because the turbines were popping up all around my hometown.
Texas leads the nation in wind energy production, so Thompson's dad thought the industry would provide more opportunities and stability. Thompson was skeptical at first. He's afraid of heights. But he got a job as a technician and realized he could apply skills he'd learned while working on helicopters for the Marines.
All the same principles apply. You got your hydraulics, your electricity. It's just working on a turbine, you're 300 feet off the ground instead of working on a helicopter that's on the ground.
Now Thompson's been working in wind for 13 years. He's still not fond of heights, but he says it's rewarding to get a down turbine back online.
I always took a lot of pride in doing my work and doing it correctly.
Today he works for Invenergy and was recently promoted to manager of the Stanton Wind Farm. So he's glad he took his dad's advice and tried a career in renewable energy.
I love the job.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
German police reported today that hundreds of electric scooter users have lost their driving licenses while celebrating Oktoberfest in Munich. 414 people were caught riding e-scooters drunk at the large beer festival, with almost 300 losing their licenses as a result. E-scooters were legalized earlier this year in Germany and are categorized as motorized vehicles. The same drinking and driving laws apply to riders. E-scooters presented a new challenge to German police as the 16-day Oktoberfest approached. Efforts to keep the festival clear of the vehicles resulted in massive clusters of abandoned scooters removed from the city each night. The scooters' appeal is their quick and affordable way to make short trips within highly populated and congested areas. Once the user has logged out of the scooter app, the vehicles can be ditched practically anywhere. A number of cities throughout Germany have reported accidents involving alcohol usage in e-scooters since their legalization in June. Several police were injured in a brawl in the city of Erfurt, where they attempted to prevent a drunken scooter operator from riding.
Have you ever wanted to see a shipwreck preserved underwater? Well, Lake Huron has ideal conditions for this kind of preservation, and Thunder Bay in the lake attracts many visitors hoping to see a glimpse of ships past. With more on this story, it is CurrentCast.
Archaeological history preserved in the Great Lakes on this CurrentCast. The cold, fresh water of Lake Huron makes it ideal for preserving the historic shipwrecks that are part of the Thunder Bay National Marine Sanctuary. Superintendent Jeff Gray says that although the monuments and sites might be underwater, there's plenty to see.
We really work hard to encourage people to get out in the sanctuary and experience some of these magnificently preserved shipwrecks. And you can do that through diving, kayaking, snorkeling, and we even have a glass-bottom boat now that takes people out and they can go see a shipwreck without getting wet.
There are over 24 documented shipwrecks that can be explored, making Thunder Bay perfect for anyone wanting to experience this national treasure. CurrentCast is produced in partnership with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, October 7th, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. You can call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Kevin Dugan and Jeffrey Wade. The producer is Claire Rosciato, and our engineer is Danielle Parks. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Michelle Coppola. If you are a fan of fermented foods, you do not want to miss News in Depth. It's coming up next on KBOO.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Way back before the age of refrigerators and freezers, people preserved their food using a process called fermentation. In fact, it's no exaggeration to say that fermentation has been essential for our survival as humans. This process is still with us today, a necessary part of making some of our favorite foods and beverages, including pickles, cheese, kimchi, miso, kombucha, wine, and beer. And our city celebrates this process of fermentation and its many delights each year with the Portland Fermentation Festival, affectionately known as Stinkfest. The festival is now in its 10th year and takes place this Thursday, October 10th, from 6 to 9:30 at EcoTrust Billy Frank Jr. Conference Center in Portland's Pearl District. Here to tell us more about the Portland Fermentation Festival, we're fortunate to have the organizers Liz Crane, Heidi Nessler, and Claudia Lucero, collectively known as the Stinkfest Queens. And that's on your website, so this is not pejorative. Liz, Heidi, and Claudia, thanks so much for coming into KBOO and bringing this feast with you. There's wine here. There's a whole plate of fermented goods, edibles, on the table.
You're welcome. We're excited for you to try.
So let's get a little background first. Liz, can you give us a little background on fermentation and how the Portland Fermentation Festival came about? I looked up what the process is, and it's basically a chemical breakdown of food substances by microorganisms. So if that helps.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, they're all different types of microorganisms that are working on the foods. A lot of the foods that we brought you today to sample, since it is kind of dinner time and maybe you're hungry for some fermented samples, are lactobacilli ferments. But yeah, we have all different, the festival started 10 years ago. This is our 10th annual. We've always had it at EcoTrust in the Pearl, and they're a great home for us. And we have a non-transactional kind of mission for it. So you pay to get in, and then once you get in there, you're not being sold to. So you're
there's no sales.
And yeah, it's important. I think that there's so many kind of high ticket food festivals these days where, you know, you kind of get in line and you feel like you're being sold to rather than having conversations and getting inspired. And kids 12 and under get in for free. So that's sort of the festival vibe of our, bring back loyal folks that want to talk to one another and celebrate.
Now, I want to get into each of you individually, and Liz, you first here. You're all festival organizers, of course, And your background is as a food writer. Actually, you've been on KBOO before, and you've done Between the Covers interview last year with Edward Lee, the Korean-American chef who came in and actually was in a documentary.
Yeah.
Maybe the definitive documentary on fermentation.
Fermented. That was so great. They showed that with the Portland Book Festival.
Yes, I just want to mention a few of your books. The Food Lover's Guide to Portland, maybe one of the most popular food books in Portland. Hello, My Name is Tasty. So the Tasty Cookbook, the Toro Bravo Cookbook, the Grow Your Own book. You did the cooking with cannabis parts of that, and we had you on. And you have a new book in the works, Dumplings Equal Love.
Thank you.
So you're a central figure. It's obvious to see in the Portland food scene. How did you get involved with the festival? Were you one of the original organizers?
Yeah, there were three of us that founded the festival, and I'd interviewed Sandor Alex Katz, who's one of our, we're the festival queens, and we consider Sandor the king. So he came and spoke at our festival the first year to kick it off, and then he's been back since. But he wrote the book Wild Fermentation and the Art of Fermentation.
And you have an interview with him in The Believer, which I read before while preparing for this.
Oh,
and
great.
That's online. Yeah. That's available for anybody if they look up Sanders' name and Liz Crane and The Believer magazine.
Yeah.
They could find that.
Thank you. Yeah.
Now Heidi, you have your own food business here in Portland, Wanpako Natto.
Yes.
And natto is a dish you picked up while living in Japan, which is made from fermented soybeans. Did that stay in Japan lead to your love for fermented foods, maybe ones that you weren't finding in the U.S., and your involvement with the festival?
Yeah, absolutely. I first tried many things that I just loved and didn't know were fermented and started making them myself in Japan. A lot of the tsukemono, the traditional Japanese pickled vegetables, I was making those, and I wasn't making natto in Japan, but I loved natto the first time I had it. So you have a little sample of natto here. You can see it.
Oh, which is the natto? We have a whole plate of fermented food here.
So the natto is the one in the middle, and I served it atop rice for you. So natto is naturally sticky from the fermentation process, and it's typically eaten for breakfast, although I know it's dinner. You can have it
anytime. Mentioned that. I read that on the website.
Yeah. A Japanese breakfast is chock full of fermented foods. Rice, miso soup. Of course, you can make miso soup with those little samples there. So maybe some pickled vegetables, some natto. And so that's how, traditionally Japanese people started the day.
Now, I'm curious, when preparing for the interview, a lot of the fermented foods, including the ones that we'll see at the fermentation festival, are Asian in origin, Japan, Chinese, Korean. Is there a reason for that? Is that cultural, or is that because the refrigeration there is not as widespread as it is in the U.S. and they needed to preserve the foods more?
Yeah, I think also using soybeans. I think traditional Asian cultures understood that soybeans needed a special treatment, meaning fermentation. So miso, tempeh, natto, shoyu, all of those start with soybeans and are fermented. Mm-hmm. So, and I think all cultures have fermentation traditions. That special connection with Japan, though, with our festival, I think really comes from Liz. And you've been to Tokyo a few times now, right?
Yeah, so many Portland Japanese food businesses. We have Jurenji Miso, and we have Gabe Rosen, who has Giraffe and Cargo, and he used to have Biwa. We have a kind of vibrant Japanese ferment culture here with Umi Organic ramen noodles, too, that work well with ferments, even though they're not fermented.
And
those
Portland's
cultures are just
place.
So old, right?
Yeah.
So, like, our culture is younger. So, the older a culture, kind of the accrual of more fermentation. But we do have quite a lot. We'll always have choi's kimchi, Korean ferments. We've had makgeolli before, another Korean. Yeah, but there's a lot of different cultures that are represented in terms of the ferments.
Yeah.
Oh, Claudia, I want to get to you. You founded a food business here in Portland as well, Urban Cheesecraft.
Oh, okay.
And your website lists you as the company's CEO or Cheesy Experience Officer.
That's right.
Now, cheese, it's probably my favorite fermented food. I eat a lot of it. How did you join Liz and Heidi in organizing the festival, and what will Urban Cheesecraft be offering there?
Let's see. I came in, I think, as an exhibitor and as a demo leader. So there are workshops, short demonstrations that we bring people on to lead, and it'll be anything from, you know, sourdough to vinegars made from scraps, kimchi, and so I brought cheese for years, and I was doing vegan cheeses and yogurt cheeses from dairy and goat's milk cheeses, and also had a booth there, and it just kind of became the thing that I put everything aside for, including anniversary with my partner, trips. Yeah, you know, it's like this came first. It was because it's really refreshing that there are no sales. It's really nice as a maker who got into this as something that I really enjoyed to get back into just talking with people and just kind of passing that wow factor onto them, and not just being about like, here are my cheese making kits, here are my books, I want you to buy them. Although that was a plug, wasn't it?
That
totally
was one
accidental.
That was one of the objectives of the interview. I meant for that, so that's not a problem at all. Now we mentioned, of course, there'll be food there, and not for sale. The food is for sampling. There'll be demonstrations, and you have an extremely special guest, actually one of the top fermentation experts in the world, coming in from Denmark, and that's David Zilber, and he's in charge of fermentation. In fact, he has a fermentation lab there at the restaurant Noma in Copenhagen. It's a 2-Michelin-star restaurant. It was named the best restaurant in the world 4 times, so this is pretty high. This is elite when it comes to food luminaries. And he's the co-author of The Noma Guide to Fermentation. How'd you get David here? And what will David be doing there? He'll be giving a talk, right, to start off the festival
at
6 o'clock.
The festival kickoff talk. Claudia has the same publishing family as David, The Noma Guide to Fermentation. And the book that he co-authored with Renee Redzepi, Chef at Noma, came out right before our festival last year. And I think we all just have really appreciated working with it and reading it for the past year, and just sort of dreamed big, and Claudia asked, and it worked out. Also, it was helpful. David is doing a dinner the night before at Plaza del Toro. Unfortunately, it's sold out.
I was going to mention it was open to the public, but too late.
It's too late, unfortunately, and there's a very long wait list, actually. But it's special because, you know, Noma is really known for their foraging. They've been known for that for years. Only the past several years, they started this really robust fermentation program. And so the chefs that work with John and Renee Gorham at Toro Bravo Incorporated and at Plaza are making all different ferments from the book with Pacific Northwest ingredients. But we're excited for his talk. We sort of given him free rein to, you know, talk about what's inspiring him right now. And then there'll be a Q&A after. And the tickets for that are also sold out, unfortunately, but we do have the second tasting at the Portland Fermentation Festival this Thursday. Those tickets are still available, and I imagine you'll be able to get those probably at the door. We'll definitely leave some aside. So
I have one quote from there was actually a really nice profile of him in The Guardian, the British newspaper. He said, "There's something else out there that's capable of producing flavors that people have never tasted or imagined before. That's the end game." Mm-hmm. So he kind of sees fermentation as a way of exploring new experiences in eating, and in ways to prepare foods that have been prepared other ways, or just getting new flavors that we've never tasted. There's a real sense of adventure there, and that must be a big part of the festival.
I think that's always been a huge part of the festival spirit, is just that really creative, do it yourself, try out these, you know, a lot of the ferments are culturally based. So as you were talking about Asian ferments and different families around the world, Eastern European ferments. But then when you're using your ingredients and your background and your kitchen terroir of microbes that are in there, then it becomes something else. So that's a big part of our festival feeling, is to kind of get funky, be creative, and, you know, try new things. Yeah. And
there'll be some attendee-related events where they're actually kind of will be doing things or bringing things to the festival.
The fermentation station and the SCOBY adoption.
Yeah. So we started last year the fermentation station just because I thought, you know, that's what I do with my business, is teach people, really kind of get them involved. I don't want to sell ready-made cheese. There's plenty of that. I kind of want to
have them make it.
Have them make it and have people feel empowered by that. So I thought, we need that component. Let's try it. And, of course, the ladies were the queens.
The Stinkfest queens.
The Stinkfest queens were all for it. So we get people there. People's Co-op actually donates all of the vegetables for it. We shred them all. We bring in salt and spices. And then we get people to crush them all up and pack them into little jars and then take their little baby sauerkraut home to continue fermenting. So that's one way that we can get them started right on that day. And then the other is the SCOBY Adoption Center, or the Starter Adoption Center. So that means anybody who's coming, because these starters, a lot of them proliferate and they make their own babies. And then you need to share them. And that's kind of how it spreads culturally in more the way than one. So we have an area set out for people to bring in their kefir grains or their extra kombucha scobies or a little bit of extra sourdough starter, and then take one or bring one and just share.
So it's a real hands-on festival. It's not just listening to other people and tasting other people's food. We have probably about a minute or so, so I wanted to get a little bit to the food here before we sign off and give people the website and all that information. Okay. Did you want to go through some of the food that I've got right in front of me? And I'm salivating.
So you've got the natto in the middle. This is a krautchi, very much inspired by Sandra Katz's free-for-all fermenting cabbage and such. It's very heavy on the ginger. These are two different misos. This one I made, it's about a year old. This is about 5 years old from Liz.
And that one is the Noma. That's from the Noma cookbook. So it's a fermented mushroom. Theirs is for porcini or bolitz, but I use chanterelles because those are, and then the juice
in
from
season
it.
Season right now, right there.
Yeah. And then I brought you a goat cheese.
Oh, that's over here?
Yes, with fermented garlic cloves in honey, or the honey itself actually fermented the garlic cloves, and then I drizzled that over the goat cheese for you. There's also an almond-based cheese that's vegan, fermented with sauerkraut brine.
My, and that must be very popular in Portland with
that. That's right. They both are.
Yeah. And then there's an egg yolk there.
A cured egg yolk.
Yeah.
And of course, your wine.
Oh, yeah, and then plum wine. But also, this is sort of how the festival feels, Ken. It's like you get to walk around and talk to the makers and try, you know, 1 to 10 different things at each table. And we have, 20-plus exhibitors this year? It's really
and sometimes
a feast.
They do unusual things that they don't get a chance to do otherwise. So.
Well, I'm getting the signal that we need to wrap up. I'm also salivating here. But Liz, Heidi, and Claudia, again, I know this is a very busy week for you, so thanks for taking the time out to visit us at KABU today.
Thank you so much.
We've been talking with Liz Crane, Heidi Nessler, and Claudia Lucero, organizers of the 10th Annual Portland Fermentation Festival. Takes place this Thursday, October 10th from 6 to 9:30 at EcoTrust Billy Frank Jr. Conference Center. That's located at 721 Northwest 9th Avenue in Portland. You can find out all the details and how to get your tickets on their website, portlandfermentationfestival.com, and on the festival's Facebook page. This is Ken Jones for KABU's News in Depth.
I've been a ramp on the ramp and road.
I didn't know if I could actually take it.
KABU is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Folk Music Society 2019-20 concert season. Bill Staines is the featured artist for the upcoming October 11 concert. Bill Staines is a singer-songwriter whose career has spanned 5 decades, and his songs have been recorded by many well-known artists. That's Bill Staines in concert, Friday, October 11 at 7:30 p.m. at the Reedwood Friends Church, 2901 Southeast Steel Street in Portland. For more information, go to kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.